The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What are you doing down there, Paddy?
I'm just looking at the latest Charlie Tyrwhitt catalogue.
Is this for your next night out?
No, I'm never going out again. I went out last night. Jesus.
Hello, everyone. This is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barclay, welcoming you back to another edition of Football Ruin My Life. And this week, for the second time, we're going to be devoting an episode to your letters to us. I make this anguished plea every week, as you all know, so to demonstrate the fact that all of us read all of your communications, we've decided to make readers' letters, as I insist on calling them, an irregular feature of the podcast. And once again, I have to report a very high standard of literacy and a comfortingly accurate recall of matches from the dim recesses of our childhoods. We do get the occasional response that is less than flattering. It's usually directed at our fallible memories, or Paddy's victimised team of researchers, as we like to think of it, but it invariably comes out all right in the end. For example, here's an online review from Ali KT, which gets to the point very quickly. Football ruined my life. A rose-tinted look back at footy, dripping with disproportionate nostalgia, overrating past players who would not get a kick in today's game, glossing over piss-soaked terraces manned by bother boys, ignoring long ball tactics that made many games unwatchable. Absolutely fantastic. Sell me a one-way ticket on this glorified journey into the past. Well, as you all know, and presumably like, we are the equivalent of three old men in a corner table in the pub. In my case, nursing a glass of lemonade in the event of the pub not serving dandelion and burdock, nattering away about the game as we remember it and comparing it to the game we watch now. So pull up a chair and join us. It's John's turn to get the drinks in. But before you go to the bar, John, what have you got for us?
Well, yes, I think we should start, and I'm relying on you because I'm technologically not the best, but to read out the letter from Christopher Stone.
Are you asking me to read out the
I'm afraid so.
Your letter?
I can do it because it concerns a Scottish international. Christopher Stone asks, can any of you remember Charlie Cannonball Fleming, who played for Sunderland in the old First Division 1955 to 58? He reputedly had one of the hardest shots in football. The clue's in the nickname, I suppose, scoring 71 goals in 122 appearances, including 25 in the league in the 56-7 season. Left Sunderland in 58 to join Bath City at the relatively young age of 31, where apparently he could earn more money in non-league football due to the maximum wage rule. I seem to remember him being called Charlie Legs Fleming.
No, he was Cannonball, as I recall. And I do remember him playing for Sunderland. I must have seen it. But, of course, the interesting bit is this bit about moving to Bath City. Now, Bath City were an interesting club. They actually were trying to get into the league, I think. And they did spend a lot of money. I'm not quite sure how or, in fact, why. But yes, there must have been something to do with the maximum wage, and he could earn more money playing outside the league for Bath City, who, of course, have never actually been a league club. There were others who did that. There was a man called Ian McFarlane, who came to Leicester as a fullback and played only a few games. I think he came from Chelsea, and he also moved to Bath City. So if any readers have the answer as to why Bath City did what they did at that point, I'd be very interested to know.
Do we know when? When were Bath City on the verge of getting into the Football League?
This is late 50s, early 60s.
That's interesting, because the person who got his first job as a manager of Bath City in 1963 was... dot, dot, dot. Anybody know?
Malcolm Allison.
Correct. So they're signing Allison in 63 at a time when they are looking very much to go upwards, aren't they?
Yes. Mm. To go back to Charlie Cannonball Fleming, a little known fact about him is that as an international player, he averaged 2 goals per match.
Did he only play one?
He played one for Scotland against Northern Ireland, scored twice in a 3-1 win. And mysteriously, actually, it wouldn't be mysteriously, I'm sure the reason would be that he didn't play for Rangers or bloody Celtic, that he never got another cap. He was from the Fife Coalfields, as they were at the time, and joined East Fife, where he made his reputation, scoring 117 goals in only 117 appearances. That's what earned him his pretty big money transfer to Sunderland. It was £20,000 plus Tommy Wright.
So his international record would stand comparison with the greatest football manager of all time, international football manager of all time, which was Sam Allardyce, who also had 100% record of victory.
And David Nugent, who came on as a sub for England for 3 minutes and scored, never to play again.
Can I give you one last thing on Scottish football? Because East Fife, God, you know, not these days noted, but they did have a great period under the management of Scott Simon, who went on to be a very successful manager at Rangers. But a little known fact about Scott Simon is that he took 5 wickets in an innings for Scotland against Australia. And I would love to say that he got Bradman's wicket, but I'm afraid we're talking different eras. He got a, what is known as a fifer. So the East Fifer got a fifer.
Did Forfar get four in the same
game? No.
Let me return to the reader's letters. I want to begin my selection with complaints. One of them is from David Cartledge, who's written a couple of times to us, says, I must admit, I really enjoy your podcast, but I do get annoyed with your tunnel vision. Today, I listened to your podcast on retirement. You mentioned support for players, but no mention of SCOBA, Stoke City Old Boys Association. Here, the players support each other and have had some famous members, i.e. Gordon Banks and Sir Geoff Hurst. They also support the community and have backing from the club. Another mention was what players do after retirement. Many Stoke players set up pottery businesses, of which most are still going. And one famous ex-player and manager, Lou Macari, is famous for setting up a hub to help homeless people. Please keep up the good work, but try to look at other football clubs other than your own small niche.
Well, as we know, and this is pre-knowledge, we do have a special edition on Stoke City coming up shortly. Yep. So hold your breath and your letter writing for a little bit, because we will be covering that supposed gap in where we get to.
Next letter, Paddy.
Yes, well, I've got one that I absolutely loved from Mark Brennand. Again, Mark, thank you very much for saying encouraging things about the podcast. But he was inspired to get in touch after listening to the episode called Money, Money, Money. And I think it was you, John, who he remembers saying that it would be impossible to turn down the opportunity to play for a top First Division side or Premier League side rather than pursue A-levels and perhaps university. Well, Mark Brennan did the latter. As a little lad growing up in the 1970s, I was good enough to be selected for the Wolverhampton Town Schools team. In 1977, the Wolverhampton Wanderers youth side was short of a couple of players. So he, Mark, was asked if he'd like to turn out in an away fixture at Bristol City. He agreed to do so. Turned up at Molyneux, was met by John Jarman, who was part of John Barnwell's coaching team some years later. And he was youth team coach at the time. Poor John is no longer with us and therefore can't respond to the allegation that he didn't introduce Mark, to any of his teammates on the day. So on the journey down, says Mark, I sat close to the front of the bus on my own. And when we arrived in Bristol, there was a cursory introduction to my teammates before they took the field. It was not one of his standout games, recalls Mark, but he did score in a one-all draw. Back to the changing room to shower and change, and, you know, I'm sure he expected a few pats on the back for rescuing a point. But no, he was just given a Mars bar, and he sat on his tod all the way back. And he said they never heard from Wolves again. At that time, the club was in the first division with a side containing the likes of Derek Parkin, Frank Munro, Dundee Boy, Mike Bailey, Kenny Hibbett. We've talked about quite a few of these players, not least the next one he mentions, Derek Dugan, John Richards. What a partnership those two were. And Colin, just for you, Dave Wagstaff.
David Wagstaff,
who,
yes.
An excellent winger with Manchester City as well. To say that I felt underwhelmed, Mark recalls, was probably an understatement and did much to encourage me to go to university, where I enjoyed a high standard of football rather than pursuing a professional career, which may or may not have been available. But isn't that an interesting insight, thanks Mark, into the life of the aspiring footballer?
It doesn't require to have FA coaching badges or FIFA coaching badges to work out. If you've got a young kid coming into a team for the first time, the best thing you could possibly do is to get him to be known by his other teammates. I mean, what on earth were they thinking of? I mean, it doesn't require extraordinary intelligence.
I know, and I can't help thinking, you know, because as many listeners have been kind enough to point out, we do have a tendency towards sentimentality and so on. But I don't think that would happen today. I think society today would make it virtually impossible for a young lad not to be...
Well, possibly. Although I do think that possibly Jarman felt, oh, the possibility of playing at that high level would still be enough that bugger the rest of it in those terms. He ought to have been sufficiently starstruck and, a phrase much used in football, want it enough not to require, as football would have said in those days, a lot of them, mollycoddling.
Yes, that's right. There was a genuine feeling of sink or swim, and that was the way of sorting out the wheat from the chaff.
Nevertheless, I think you're right, Paddy. I don't think that would happen now. Mm. And I think in those days there was a feeling that the youth team coach was not an important position at the club, often given to someone who played with the manager, was a pal of his, and will give him the youth team to sort out.
Yeah.
I remember John Samuels, who played for Arsenal and Leicester, lovely fella. It was a brilliant example to young players. I always felt, always a great pro. And when he was retiring, he was offered positions as youth team coach, where I think he would have been brilliant. I said to him, John, why didn't you do it? And he said, I've seen too many youth team coaches confined to just dropping cones out and not being regarded as a proper member of the coaching team. So a lot has altered in that respect.
Right, back to the letters. This one's interesting. It says, a quick note to say thank you for the podcast. I enjoy it immensely. I have to admit, being a sprightly 55, so not as storied in history as you all quite yet. My team is Ipswich Town, and it is with reference to the episode on administration with David Bernstein that I write. Mine is a club totally built on romance and overachievement, a sleepy rural backwater producing two league champions, 1963, which I'm afraid he's wrong, it was 1962, and FA Cup winners, 1978, UEFA Cup champions, 1981, and two England managers in the underachieving Alf Ramsey and St. Bobby Robson. Had we been able to complete a treble in 1981, when the sublime Kevin Beattie decided to set fire to himself, putting out that ambition, we would probably have been rightly regarded as one of the greatest sides of all time and might have established a dynastic legacy to rival the modern-day Manchester City. Well, do you think that's slightly overwritten, or do we encourage that?
It's what's known as self-parody, Colin.
Oh, you think so?
I think he's poking gentle fun at himself. But he's dead right to point out the magnificent achievements of a club which didn't join the league until, I don't know, comparatively. Well, success quickly followed, I think, as I recall.
Well, he, of course, doesn't mention the factor of the Cobbold family.
No, he doesn't.
Lady Blanche and the two brothers, John and Patrick, who, when Ipswich were drawn in the cup away to Mansfield during one of those winters that we used to get where matches were frequently postponed. Mm. And the match against Mansfield was postponed three or four times. Now, it so happened that the chairman of Mansfield at that time was a man called Arthur Patrick, who decided to ring the Cobbold Brewery in order to apologise to John at that point, who was chairman of Ipswich. The receptionist at the Cobbold Brewery put the call through saying, "It's Mr. Patrick on the phone for you." At which point, of course, John assumed, as they were known in the brewery as Mr. John and Mr. Patrick, that the person ringing was, in fact, his brother. Mm-hmm. And Arthur Patrick began by saying, "I'm terribly sorry about the game being postponed. We're having an awful time." At which point, John replied to him, "Yes, a fucking disgrace. What the hell are we going to bloody Mansfield for? Slum of a place. I hate it. Why don't they give us a bye?" But when the astonished Mr. Arthur Patrick then sort of spluttered a bit, the climb down by Mr. John was apparently even more brilliant.
I just want to finish off this very interesting little email. He finishes by saying, "I eschew the idea of, quotes, big clubs and, quotes, seats at the table by dint of size, and wholeheartedly agree that we must have a commissioner with genuine teeth and a system of regulation that enshrines not quite Corinthian ideals in the league and structure of football, but one which regulates for the fans and for the clubs." Mm. And I think we can all say amen to that, can't we?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, here's Sprightly 55, I think you said, Colin. Well, I can do better than that. I have a letter from Danny Stewart, aged 28.
Yes.
The thing is that Danny, well, I'll just read his letter. He's a Glasgow Rangers fan, but, you know, I'm not going to let that put me off because he seems like a nice guy. "I just wanted to write in and say that as a younger person with a great fondness for football of the 50s to the 70s, this is exactly the kind of piece of media I was crying out for. Long may it continue." Well, it will continue, I hope, for as long as we do. "As suggestions for future episodes are mentioned as being welcomed, such as another year to focus on following the 1963 episode, he's got a couple to chuck in. Danny wants the year 1967, and well said, Danny, because Scots all remember that we became world champions through winning at Wembley in that year. He also wants special episodes on players, and he mentions Finney and Matthews. Another great idea. He wants one on the effect the Second World War had on playing careers.
It's very good. It's just that it's difficult to argue. It's a negative thing. It's what didn't happen to
players. That's fair enough.
We touched on that, did we not, in the reserves episode.
Yes.
That will be coming up shortly, so listen on.
I'm going to...
I just get one more thing in from Danny Stewart, my Rangers supporting friend, although I've never used that phrase before. "Please remind Paddy," he tells you, "that Dundee were not beaten fair and square by Milan in the semi-final in 1963, but were in fact the victims of a corrupt referee bribed by the Italians." Well, I want to believe you, Danny. I want to believe you so much. But I think if any Dundee club had a complaint about refereeing against an Italian club in the semi-final of the European Cup, it was Dundee United some years later when they were knocked out by Roma, who in turn lost the final to Liverpool. That it's very well documented that Dundee United were done. Whether Dundee were done in Milan, I doubt it very much. Ian Ewer, surviving distinguished member of that team, says we were beaten fair and square. So that's good enough for me.
John, what's your next letter?
Well, we had a letter from Gordon Smith. It's quite a long letter, so I'm going to abbreviate and get, as I see it, to the two bits that are of particular interest. Gordon Smith starts off saying he'd recently become aware of your podcast. Well, thank you, and tell all your mates. And I've listened to lots of them during the festive period. I've loved all of the episodes I've heard, which is nice. Thank you. But he says that he has fond memories of Terry Cooper, who was the outstanding fullback for Leeds and England. Terry lived in Fairburn near Leeds, which was where he lived, And he remembers that when he was a member of the 1970 World Cup squad, all members of that squad were given a Ford Cortina, which was embellished with a large rosette and the name of the sponsor, which was Findus Foods. Actually, I know about those cars because Peter Shilton once had it. It wasn't the car that I disposed of when he moved to Stoke City, leading to a splenetic call from the director of Stoke City, to whom I disposed it of. But nevertheless, I do remember those cars. He also goes on about players in advertising and said Danny Blanchflower was in an advert for shredded wheat. We all remember that. Pass the hot milk, please. Several players endorsed boots and sports clothing, including Stanley Matthews. I can remember getting a pair of Stanley Matthews boots, which I insisted on. My mother was not pleased. There was also a alcohol-sponsored advert. I don't think you get that these days. But this one featured Bobby Moore visiting a pub. And Gordon goes on to say, did any footballers endorse tobacco? Yes, they did. Mm. Eddie Bailey of Tottenham Hotspur was very keen, apparently, on Craven A. Yeah. Other brands are available. And he always felt that to have a quick one at half-time absolutely refreshed him. And I've got that actual advert. It's in my Charles Buchan's first 12 editions, which my wife got me from an antique market in Lincolnshire.
God. It's interesting. When I was in, you know, my little brush with fame, when I was training with Manchester City in the 1971 club pre-season, one of the things I remember so clearly and shocked me was to see after the training session, we all piled back into the dressing room, and Tony Book's first thing was to search in his jaggy pocket, produce a packet of 20 and light up in the dressing room. I was absolutely astonished.
Well, he never lasted, did he?
Well, he lasted until he was 83. He was playing in his early 80s. And he was the quickest player on that team. But football and smoking seemed to me always to be the wrong thing to do, even though the tobacco companies say this connection wasn't made until the 1990s or something.
Yeah, I certainly remember there being a certain amount of eyebrow raising in English dressing rooms when players from the continent of Europe started coming in the, what was it, the 1990s, that sort of time. And a lot of them would light up. They wouldn't drink, they ate the right things and so on, because this, of course, was the times associated with Arsene Wenger when the footballer's lifestyle became more healthy. But the English players, one or two mentioned to me that they were surprised when these paragons of fitness would light up a fag during, before training or whatever it was.
Stephen Towler writes very briefly, I really enjoy the podcast. Listening to the Midlands episode reminded me that in 1969, Leeds was home to the Football League champions, Leeds United, the County Cricket champions, Yorkshire, and the Rugby League champions, Leeds Rugby League FC. Very good point. And in fact, that is something that I have actually got on my list of future episodes for us to think about, having come from Lancashire. Why teams in Lancashire, with much the same climatic conditions, have been so much more successful over the years than teams in Yorkshire, because there are Yorkshire teams, but they've not remotely been as successful as the teams from my side of the Pennines. Mm. It's an interesting point and one we can do in the future.
Does the answer concern waterlogged pitches?
You think it doesn't rain on our side of the Pennines?
No, I remember my son going to university in Manchester and ringing me after 3 weeks to say, Dad, it rains here every day.
Yes. So why would that benefit us?
Well, you're used to playing on soggy pitches up there.
Yeah.
The rest of us who played on proper pitches never got the chance.
Since we're talking about Lancashire, may I dwell on Wigan for a little bit?
Yes.
Through the prism of Phil Crompton, who, again, God, they're a kind bunch, our listeners, because he says each episode has been uplifting. They enhance his dog walks around the fields of the Trent Valley with Milo, his spaniel. But he has got one thing wrong, because he says the relationship between the three of you is so warm. my God. Kobrak has actually had to get in and stop fights on four occasions, all involving John Holmes, I guess. But anyway, although he lives in the Trent Valley, he loves Wigan Athletic. He first went to see them in 1967 at Springfield Park, when they were in the Cheshire League. And I, from my journalistic days, I do remember Wigan as a non-league club. But the highlight of Phil Crompton's school days was a visit to Main Road on January the 2nd, 1971, to watch the Latics lose 1-0 to a late goal from the great Colin Bell. And he remembers we were on Match of the Day and comments, blimey. Since then, of course, we've beaten City three times in the Cup, including, and my God, Phil, you're not alone in relishing this, the best day of my life, don't tell the missus, when Ben Watson scored in the last minute at Wembley in 2013. The second best day might have been the day we were elected to the league in 1978. My mates at the University of Hull will confirm that I emerged from a telephone kiosk outside a pub in Cottingham with a smile and a whoop of delight. Such good memories. I'm still a fan and get to matches pretty regularly, floods permitting, despite living in Nottingham. Oh, that's great, Phil. Thank you.
It does interest me, though, despite the fact we are separated by our devotion to different clubs, we are completely united as a community of football supporters by letters exactly like that, by the stories of triumphs and disasters. We can empathise so easily with supporters of other clubs. So it's great to get these letters that just confirm that sense of we're all in this together,
community.
We're all enslaved by the game.
That's right.
John, do you have another one?
Well, just a brief mention of an email from Simon Merwood Palmer, who's a Pompey fan. And he has been a Pompey fan for a long time, which reminded me of a couple of things. First of all, my first day at university, I had 3 1-hour lectures on the trot on a Monday morning. And that was the only time ever at university I attended all those three lectures. 2 hours had about done me in, then the third hour on Plato's Republic completely did me in, and I never went to that again. However, there was one moment in a lecture given by Professor Geoffrey Fry, whom at one point said Walpole was then relegated from the cabinet, just as Portsmouth will be this season. It sort of woke me up at that one. Here is a university lecturer talking about football in the middle of something to do with 18th century British politics. So I approached him at the end and said, I saw Portsmouth play the other week. They played Leicester, and I don't think they'll be relegated. And he looked at me, his eyes blazed, and said, Leicester, they ruined my life.
Oh, really?
Said, why was that? He said, because in 1949, we were going to win the double. I was taken to Highbury to watch the title-winning side of Portsmouth march on to the cup final. They were well clear in the league, and we were going to win the double. And amazingly, in one of the great shocks of that era, Leicester beat them 3-1, only to get to the cup final. And as ever, during that period, Leicester lost to Wolves. Well, I didn't go to that game, but the basis of that conversation formed a lifelong friendship with Geoff Fry. Geoff Fry was one of the most ardent Pompey fans I've ever met. He saw all the ups and all the downs. And when I delivered the eulogy at his funeral last year, of course, a lot of that centred not on his academic work, but on Portsmouth.
Walpole was Prime Minister, or Primus Inter Pares, from 1721 to 1742. Makes you wonder about them today, you know, Liz Truss and her lengthy stay as Prime Minister in that context.
Maybe Walpole was a wee bit better than Liz Truss.
He was incredibly corrupt, actually, Walpole.
Was he?
He just managed to stay there for a long time.
You know, you learn so much from just sitting at the feet of Colin. I love it. But a guy I love even more than Colin is Ty Popick, who, as regular listeners will know, is unofficial head of the American branch of the Football Ruined My Life Appreciation Society. Great lad, lives in Atlanta, and he's got a serious point. Obviously, he loves football, soccer, call it what you will. But he's really troubled by the abuse of referees in football. And it was discussed in one of our podcasts a few weeks ago regarding sportsmanship. In American sports, he says, you can't even dream about getting within a few feet of, let alone making contact with, umpires, officials, referees, whatever it is. And it's much better this way, as intimidation tends to play a minor role in sports over there. He's really outraged by the way that football players crowd, hound and intimidate referees. And he says it's the only sport in the world where both teams are equally furious at the referee at exact same time. One team is furious that a yellow card isn't red, and the other team is furious that there's even a card at all. that and or players want to give the ref a laundry list of complaints from 30 minutes ago. It's comical, but it's also shameful, he says, to see both teams up in arms and hounding the referee simultaneously multiple times during the match. Well, amen to that, I say.
Yeah, we get various emails from America. There's another chap called King Arthur who alleges that I am biased towards Shilton. Really? Can't imagine how he got that impression. But he also then goes on to say that Paddy is in La La Land. He should live in Malibu. It's the La La Land here. And he then says, sport is brutal. And having done some sports writing journalism, it's sordid. Mm. But he then goes on, having accused me of being biased, to say, I am the real deal. Mm. Mr. Holmes is the man. Could listen to him all day. Yep. My wife got really cross at that.
I tell you what, I'd like a whiff of what he's been smoking, King Arthur.
But John, King Arthur has a point about one of your clients, which you've glossed over.
Well, of course.
He begins, great show, yet Shilton was not, in my humble opinion, in the same class as Ray Clemens, and goes on to list all those catalogue of Shilton mistakes.
Well, some of them weren't mistakes and some of them are over-egging the point. Shilton versus Clements. Well, in the end, England managers came out strongly, didn't they, in favour of Shilton?
Yeah.
He had double the number of caps, roughly, that Clements did. So I defer to others in their judgment of that.
Actually, to give him credit, King Arthur, well, we have to give him credit because he's a king. He writes, Poland 73, World Cup, big mistake. 86 World Cup quarters, Maradona, no spring in his step. 90 World Cup semi, deflective free kick, no spring in his step. Similar to Seaman, both not naturals. Clements had that spring in his step. The agent for Shilton, Holmes, is very biased. Still, great show. Mm-hmm. So what have you to say to that, John?
Well, Paddy said, I don't know what he's been smoking that show.
We do like receiving this stuff. I've got one to finish with, Paddy. Do you have anything there that you'd like to get on?
No, I'd like to hear yours, though.
Well, it's one of our regular correspondents, a man called David Fairholme, who lives in Scotland but is the chief Nottingham Forest supporter north of the border. Mm. And he writes, from family to franchise, this podcast expertly and emotionally spans the generations of why we used to support our local team. Mm. Post-war Britain, we all supported either the club of your birth or the club of your father. We all felt a belonging if somehow we influenced the results on the pitch. The podcast looks at the then and now, where our owners may never have heard of the club they own until their adult years. It's really a great history lesson. You know, it's nice to have the compliments, but he's making a point that means a lot to me, this idea of history, the idea of the change we have got. I mean, we know from our previous discussions that football has got better in so many areas. And I'm not contesting John's view of this. I mean, the pitches and the diet and the fitness and the pace at which it's done, the skill levels, they're all improved. The question that David raises, and the one that's always at the back of my mind, is progress doesn't necessarily mean more enjoyable. In an era of globalization, anybody can support Liverpool wherever they live in the world, and it sort of diminishes the bloke who walks there from West Kirby. I've taken it to an illogical extreme, possibly, but David does raise that point, and that's where I want to finish. I want to ask the two of you about this local versus globalization point.
I totally agree, and anybody who's been listening to these podcasts and those of you who've just picked it up, go back to the beginning and go through, because one of the points is that they don't date. And we talk about these aspects a lot. In some senses, we are repeating ourselves in doing so. But yes, part of my DNA is Leicester City. It gave me an identity when I was younger, made me feel part of a community. I can remember writing an essay. I had to write an essay at school in an English class when I first went to secondary school, saying what were the things about me that people could identify. And I said, at 4:45 on a Saturday afternoon, you will find me either at a football match or desperately listening to the radio in order to get the score. Before Paddy goes, I'd like to finish off with one letter that came from Justin Briley.
Yeah.
He says, I found your show through John's appearances on The Restless Football, which is Gary's podcast, wherein his manifest love for Leicester was moving to the point of heartbreak, reminded me of my dad talking about football here at home. I've binged every episode of your show. Wonderful work, gentlemen. The best to all of you. I'm glad that's come over, because that's the bit we do try to convey. All three of us, and Paul, the producer, we do this because we love the game and we love what it's meant to us throughout our lives. And it's obviously meant a lot to you.
Well,
is that it? Oh, sorry, Colin.
I wonder whether you have another...
Oh, no, I probably would just repeat what John's just said in different words. So sorry to have interrupted you. I think it'd be fine, Colin, if you just wind up now. Is that what you're going to do?
I was, and particularly as this show is going to go out on an Easter weekend, it is to wish all our listeners success in having laid an Easter egg trail. And Easter is also an appropriate time, because Easter traditionally has been the time when, you know, I remember the year City won the league in 68, we played Chelsea on Good Friday, we played West Ham on Easter Saturday, we then went down to London to play the return game against Chelsea, which we lost to a goal by Alan Birchinall a couple of days later. So we played three games in 4 days, nobody complained. Easter was the time which settled relegation issues and promotion issues, and that intensity and concentration of those matches in that short time frequently did have a major effect on who won and who lost, who went up and who went down. And I slightly regret that it's now gone into the middle of May before these things are happening, when the middle of a county championship season, and they should get off the stage rather more quickly, as indeed I will too. So thank you to John, as ever, and thank you to Paddy, as ever. Even more, thank you to our indefatigable producer, Paul Kobrak, for producing the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's a pleasure getting your letters. Please keep them coming in. So until the next time we meet on air, for the next edition of Football Ruined My Life, this is Colin Schindler saying thanks for listening. See you next time. Cheerio. Do we want to have an edition where we actually have maybe just one or two? I mean, do we want to invite them onto the show or not?
You could have an auction to appear on the show.
I think we're succumbing to commerciality. Next thing we know, we'll get sponsored by Craven A Cigarettes or something. Yeah.